all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
Yeah, nice fade there, Derek. Nice. Hey, Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year, Robert. How are you?
And, you know, there's no, how do they say it? There's Robert and Bob. What do they call that? Or the proper name, isn't that what
proper name. I always like using
but there's
proper
not,
names.
What's Dale?
No, there's Dale and then there's Dale.
Then there's Dale.
Or there's Dingbat or
you could, well, you
other
be
things.
Daring Dale or you can be a, but anyway, Happy New Year.
Thank you very much.
And Santa was good?
Santa was very good to me, and Santa obviously was very good to Nina, who's over in the other control room. She finally got a nice winter coat.
She needed it.
No more layering for Nina.
Oh, holy moly. I mean, look outside.
It's a great-looking coat, too.
Yeah, so maybe we should do a remote in Florida next week, eh?
It might be. It's that kind of weather. It's starting to be that kind of weather.
Okay, well, Nina's right now is getting our first guest on the air. Anything important? Well, we got some new stuff happening. And what about the Navy laser? What about that?
Yeah, well, that's coming up in a couple of weeks.
I know.
That's what Jim is going to be talking about. With that, he's going to be doing a program on the new laser weaponry, and I'm sure that Dr. Grant could address that a little bit during your interview with her. The other things going on, of course, is everybody, if you go to our website, you can get a copy of our book. We have a book.
We got a book. Published.
We are published. It's called Vietnam Story.
It made the Times.
Yes, it.
It made the Times.
Yeah, somebody wrapped it.
Not
in the
New York Times, no.
But it's
the Hoboken Times. Oh, I'm sorry. Anybody out there from Hoboken?
Hey, I was in Hoboken last week. Vietnam Stories, Best of Veterans Radio, 7 stories that we've had on the program over the last 11 years now. I think you'll find them really powerful.
You haven't changed a bit.
I looked at a picture the other day and I wanted to know who that was. But the, you know, you look in the mirror now and you see your father and you go, ah! You know, it's just this sudden
what was
shock
that movie?
Syndrome.
Was it Dorian Gray where was it the picture gets older or the picture stays young?
I think the picture, I forget, but
I
know what you're talking about.
Dana Andrews,
scared
I think,
of
was in that, yeah. Anyway, so, but you had a great holiday. I know
I
you went up, to Jersey.
Went to New Jersey and saw a number of Jersey girls and guys and set our own Jersey boys, and I wanted to make sure that everybody's doing well out there and appreciate all of your support and help over the last 11 years. I went back to talk to my friends, Ray's family.
God bless.
Ray Schrader was one of our initial contributors who got us on the air.
God's gone.
And so we wanted to make sure that we thank them. And they're doing as well as can be expected. And so we're just going to encourage them to listen, and our prayers and best wishes go to the whole Schrader family.
Well, I have in my hand the book.
You
yes,
do.
I do. Vietnam Stories, Best of Veterans Radio, Dale Thronberry, Bob Gould, James G. Falsone, Esquire.
I
didn't know that. I thought that must mean attorney.
I'm guessing that it
I'm
does.
I'm guessing it does.
I noticed we have no middle names.
That.
What?
But this is really cool, folks. Hey, how can I get one of those, Bob? Well, here's what you do. You go to our website, www.veteransradio.net, and you're going to see something right there, a button that says contribute, donate.
Contribute, donate, whatever you want to call it. You can buy the book on our website. It just it takes you to the page that says, you know, if you want to help us out, which we always, you know, this stuff all costs money, and I don't want to sound like NPR, but we are.
Well,
but you do help us.
Yeah.
We need your help once in a while. So this is one opportunity for you to help us out by purchasing the book, and you can use PayPal to pay for it. It's $25.
Or a check.
Or a check, or cash, or if you run into Bob, you know, wherever he hangs out, you can, you know, give him, slip
but
him
you some, know, what's really
slip
cool
some money.
Is that this is January, our first program
right.
for 2015, and hey, folks, we've been on the air for 11 years. We want you to keep us on the air. Right. What's the minimum? $26 for the book. Minimum.
Oh,
we'll take, but that's the minimum. $26 in a, I mean, what are you going to get for $26 today? That doesn't even buy a pound of coffee.
You can get an autographed copy of the book.
You can.
We'll sign it.
We will.
Sure. Right. Whatever name you want.
It's Vietnam. It's really cool, too. It's got our pictures in there. It's got stories. And what's Jim Falsone's crew did is that they transcribed, four of our stories? Seven of our stories?
There's seven of them in there, I believe.
But it's part of, we're doing a fund me, okay? Go fund me. We're doing it ourselves, right?
Right.
So please go to the website, veteransradio.net, and click on donate, contribution, whatever. We're going to be talking about this from time to time.
We got some other stuff that we're going to be putting up there too that you might like. Some of our shirts and hats and some other merchandise that we're going to be offering to our listeners.
Well, speaking about 2015, I happen to have our first guest today, Mr. Robert P. McDivitt, Director, VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Mr. McDivitt, Rob McDivitt, he's director. And prior to coming to Ann Arbor, he was with the medical center director at Fargo, Virginia. Medical center. Oh, wait a minute. It's called the Fargo VA. Aha, I got to read on. Medical center in North Dakota. He's a graduate of the VA Associate Director Healthcare Administrator Training Program. He really knows what he's doing. He really knows that, you know, because when I go into the Ann Arbor VA, I can really feel that organization, that leadership is there. He's also the Healthcare Leadership Institute and the Federal Interagency Institute for Healthcare Executives. He was honorably discharged veteran of the U.S. Army. Oh, there you go, folks. We heard that. Field artillery. Boy, those guys are... I know. Yeah, what? Speak louder, Bob. Okay. He's also a member of the American Legion Post 46. He holds undergraduate degrees in history, German, and graduate degrees in public management, healthcare policy from the University of Minnesota. Badger.
No.
Okay. He is a...
Gophers.
Aren't they? Oh, no, they're gophers. We're going to get letters. That's all right. At least somebody's listening will know. He's a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives and board certified in healthcare management. Give a big hand of a round of applause for Mr. Robert McDivitt. Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob and Dale. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. I'm sure you don't even recognize the guy you just introduced, right?
Well, he thought I used to work in Virginia instead of North Dakota, so it's a lot colder in North Dakota, and we're very happy to be here in Michigan.
Well, I saw, Rob, I saw the VA, and as I'm reading this, I thought it was Virginia, but we won't go there. Well, here we got 2015. A lot went on within the VA system last year, and there should be. There should always be flux. Things are changing. Situations are changing. Protocols are changing. And you, your PR person gave us a call and wanted to know if we would put you on in our inaugural program for 2015. So here we go. Rob, tell us about the Veterans Choice Act.
Sure. As you said, Bob, a lot of exciting things going on in VA. One is the implementation of the Veterans Access Choice and Accountability Act that was passed last summer. In all honesty, in the wake of the concerns going on with the Phoenix VA and others nationwide and helping us to focus on access for care for veterans. I can tell you here at the Ann Arbor VA, we're doing really very well on access. About 97% of our appointments are completed within 30 days of when the veteran would prefer the care to happen. But with the Choice Act coming online, it will give veterans and us some additional options to enhance access for care. Veterans, if they haven't already, will be receiving a card that will allow them to work with a third-party administrator, essentially an insurance company the VA hired to arrange care. If we can't provide the veteran with an appointment within 30 days when he or she would like to be seen, and as I said, we're able to do that in most cases in our healthcare system. And the Choice Act also provided VA up to $5 billion over the next 2 years to hire additional healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, social workers, to help us to further enhance access for care. And in our healthcare system in Ann Arbor, we were approved for just over 100 positions, and we are starting to to bring those people on now. We worked in partnership with the University of Michigan, with the St. Joseph Mercy here in our community, with the University of Toledo, and we've been able to add some staff and some slots for veterans right now. So we're really very excited as the Choice Act moves forward.
Well, I think we're very excited to hear that kind of stuff, because as I look at your bio and I see all this leadership, when things were starting to slip last year, you did something. You opened up Saturdays, hired some more doctors, and cleared up that long waiting list to get in. Boy, that was really cool, Rob, and I want to say that. I don't know about all the VAs, but the one here in Ann Arbor certainly did that. And my Veterans Radio wants to give you a big-time salute on that. So let's talk about some more about Access Eliminated Electronic Work List. What was that?
Sure. These are veterans who are waiting more than 90 days for an appointment. Last spring, we had about 400 veterans on that list. As of the 1st of December, we have 4 veterans on that list. Waiting more than 90 days from their desired date for an appointment. We work very hard, as you said. We've added evening clinics. We've run Saturday clinics. We brought in the equivalent of 5 additional providers through our partnerships in the community and created about 250 more appointment slots every week for veterans. And we really have done very well in terms of eliminating the electronic work list and getting veterans seen in a timely manner while still maintaining our historical high levels of quality and veteran satisfaction.
Okay, we just got a few more moments here, and I'm going to have to put off this transcatheter aortic valve replacement, but I want to talk about, this really sounds cool, veteran town hall meetings. Tell us about that.
Sure. We've always tried very hard to listen to the voice of veterans in all that we do, and we involve veterans in nearly everything in our healthcare system, including having a voting representative on our governance board. But our new secretary, Robert McDonald, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, West Point graduate, made sure that every VA would have a veterans town hall meeting before the end of September. We've had 2 in our healthcare system, September 22nd here in Ann Arbor and November 12th in Toledo. And we'll be doing that on an ongoing basis. And the meetings are essentially an open forum for us to listen to veterans, to learn the things we do well and build on those, and also to hear areas of concern that we need to focus on and work on. And we'll be scheduling our next quarterly town hall in the next few days, and we hope to do that in a broader forum. The first 2 were face-to-face meetings, and we may do something like a telephone meeting to try to reach out to more veterans or an online meeting. So we're really very interested in our healthcare system and listening to the voice of veterans and incorporating the great ideas we get from veterans in all that we do.
Well, way cool. How are we going to find out about these town halls besides through Veterans Radio? So you have Derek. Let us know. We'll let our listeners know. But what about somebody else out there? How are they going to find out when these town hall meetings are?
Sure. Derek will let you know as well. We'll put it on appointment cards that are going out to veterans. We also will have it posted on our webpage, which is www.annarbor, all one word, .va.gov. If you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, those meetings will be announced there as well. We'll try to get it out in as many forums as possible.
Well, I want to say to all of my veteran friends out there, and I'm sure Dale will say this too, that the My Health Vet, the town meetings, the access, all this exciting and new stuff for 2015. Dale, you got a final comment here?
Nope, I only wish you good luck, Robert, with everything that goes along with the VA. We had a little image problem last year, and now we're going to improve that image and improve the care for all those men and women out there that need your help.
And Rob and Dale, the cool thing is that something was being done. That's what it's all about. That's what the military is about. That's what the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, that's what we're all about. Rob, we want to thank you very much. Would you please come back on the program again and go a little more in detail on these programs and plans? Would you come back?
Absolutely. And I want to wish both of you and all your listeners a very happy, safe, and prosperous 2015.
Good. Thank you for the great service. Wow. Wow, that's really exciting. Nina, we're not going to go to a break. We're going to go right into our second guest, because I don't want to have one moment away. There's so much interesting. Our next guest is Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant is president of IRIS, right? I want to make sure I get that right, IRIS. Independent Research. It's a public policy research organization located in Washington, D.C. That's where everything is, right? Yeah, okay. She's also director of the Washington Security Forum. That's a nonprofit founded in 2012, encouraging research and discussion, right, all about national security. Dr. Grant is an active member of the Air Force Association. Oh, if we go into the West, oh, I love that, man. You know, if I were to go in again, I'd go in the Air Force. That's a cool job. Well, so is being in the Army. That's all cool. She writes regularly for Air Force Magazine, and served from 2008 to 2011 as the founding director of the Mitchell Institute. Dr. Grant, Veterans Radio gives you a welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Bob. Happy New Year to you and to the Veterans Radio listeners.
I do want to say, folks, that this is the third year that Dr. Grant has been with us to start off the broadcast year, and that's way cool, way cool. Well, we've got so much. I almost don't even know where to begin, and you get your pencils out, folks, and paper, because you're going to have to have a program here to find out what's going on. First thing we're going to talk about those ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq, and the Levant, which is the same thing as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. If you can figure this out, that's a Sunni Islamic rebel group. It's based in Iraq and Syria. Saddam was a Sunni. The Shia are in charge. And now the Sunnis have gone and partnered up with ISIS, and it's created this turmoil in the region, but it's like a ripple effect, and it's rippling around the world, even so much, and hang on to your hats on this one, folks, Iran is bombing ISIS. That's right. The Satan devils. Can you believe that? Politics, strange bedfellows. Tell us all about that, Dr. Grant.
Boy, you are right. Politics do make strange bedfellows, and you're right. We have to get our pencils out to keep track of what is going on in this region that stretches across Syria and down into Iran. What we have there overall is a fairly active little air war as a coalition of about 40 nations, U.S., Britain, France, many others, support Iraq's armed forces and some other folks who are trying to push back against the ISIL coalition. So what's interesting to me is that well, they really haven't taken much of a break here. This started about 3 months ago, back at the end of the summer, with some strikes, including strikes into Syria, first use of the F-22 in combat. But what we're seeing now is a fairly steady pace of very precise airstrikes on a relatively small number of targets, and they are usually timed to support some efforts by Iraq's national forces to take back territory. In fact, I don't know what you were doing on New Year's Eve, Bob. I hope you had a good one.
Yes, I did.
But I can tell you it looks like these coalition air crews over in Southwest Asia, and, of course, this is U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, Marine Corps, all of this here together, they were having a busy time keeping aircraft mission ready and flew some strikes, actually, in early January. Kind of a typical rundown, and since this isn't in the news this much, I want to just kind of talk through what they're doing. You know, they'll strike a fighting position, take out some ISIL tanks, armored vehicles. That's up in Syria. Down in Iraq, and this one time near Taji, they struck a tactical unit, airstrikes against some buildings in the Fallujah area, airstrikes against shipping containers, all very, very small, precise strikes, tightly coordinated with efforts on the ground. But make no mistake, this is still, for our U.S. air crews, a pretty active environment. That means a lot of mission planning for them, crew chiefs keeping the aircraft ready, the ordnance folks building up bombs that go on, and, you know, still pretty active over there.
Now, we're using fighters, and we're using unmanned UAVs. And here I have this little blurb here again. U.S. jets from Iran carry out airstrikes. Boy, I want you to comment on that.
Well, that's quite the headline, isn't it? U.S. jets from Iran. We have to take that apart. Do you remember back in the 1970s, before the fall of the Shah, we had pretty close relations with Iran. And as a result, Iran has some very aged F-14s. So I think these are the jets that were used in these strikes. So they were U.S. made, but no American hands have touched those jets in many a decade. But it's interesting we see Iran getting into the mix here a little bit as well. What's that old phrase, Bob? The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
Not quite there yet, but people are starting to talk about it.
I think that is absolutely incredible. Dale, what do you think about
it? No, I just agree with what Dr. Grant was saying. Also, the idea, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, we have to be very cautious about that because we've gone through this before in that part of the world. And so we just need to pay attention to what's going on. I mean, we're trying to extricate ourselves from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we, you know, it's almost it's like the Godfather, you know, like you get out and they keep pulling you back in. So we have to be careful.
Well, okay, so we have this, and by the way, folks, they want, well, I'll let Dr. What is the purpose of ESIS? What is it that they want to do?
Well, you know, they want to establish what they feel should have always been the case in that area, and that is that wide Islamic state. Not a lot of respect for the international boundaries that are there or for the duly elected government in Iraq. Think what you want about Syria, but Iraq's government is an elected government. So, you know, that's clearly a little bit different from what they're trying to do. And I think Dale is right to say, you know, let's be careful in talking about our friends. You know, our real friends are our coalition partners, Britain, France, Australia, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, you know, the Netherlands, many others, other so-called Arab states in that region, you know, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, everyone who wants to try to calm this down. The group on the ground there that goes by ISIL or sometimes now by the new acronym Daesh, they want to have it their own way, and they are thugs and terrorists and really bad dudes. And I think what's a shame in a way is, you know, the U.S. Army, Marines, and others were there and literally took and stabilized a lot of these towns back in the mid-2000s. These are familiar names. You talk about Fallujah. These are names where young Americans walked and helped with the coalition to impose peace. I think it's very hard now to watch some of those areas back under threat again. I think there are a number of people in the service who really take that personally. They were young lieutenants and captains there getting that job done, and now we have thugs and terrorists trying to run the region.
I can't stand. Right. We've talked to a number of Iraq veterans who were in Fallujah on this program, and we have also been getting feedback from them how upset and how disappointed that they are that, you know, they went there for X number of tours. They took the town back. They left it, you know, in the hands of the Iraqis and, you know, and they're losing it again. And so it's just so frustrating to these men and women to, you know, try to figure out what was their purpose there. And we can all understand that question of, you know, if you go to war and it just keeps going even after you leave, or they take back the territory that you won after you leave. It's so frustrating and so, I don't know, just tears you apart when you look at that, because your friends died in those streets.
And it's really not so much territory as it is momentum that is going back. But I still feel that, well, here, the real, you know, let's mention this. You got the Sunnis, you got the Shia, and you got the Kurds. The Kurds are holding the fort in the north. Is that correct, Dr. Grant?
Yes, that's broadly right. And we've supported the Kurds quite a bit. They do good work on the ground.
And are they actually going into Syria to doing the fighting?
Well, you know, who really knows, right? But the border there is very, very fluid, and certainly our airstrikes reach across into Syria quite frequently. And, you know, Dale is right. It's a heartbreaking disappointment, and I think that is part of what has bound these coalition partners together again in this new venture, you know, of inherent resolve, that we're going to try to get back the territory that's been taken and try to strengthen the local forces, whether they are Iraqi government, Kurds, et cetera, and try to help them keep a lid on this.
Now, where are the U.S. I take it the U.S. jets are U.S. Air Force is having airstrikes. Is that correct? Navy, Air Force?
Right. It's Navy and Air Force and Marine Corps jets as well, just like you would you expect.
Where are they leaving from?
I think they're still leaving from all those undisclosed locations up and down the Persian Gulf. The carriers operate out of the NAG, the North Arabian Gulf, or scoot up into the Persian Gulf as required. We've seen some wider use of bases. But, you know, typically, although you can look at a map and pretty much see where they're coming from, but officially we like to respect our partners in the region who allow use of bases there. And they don't like to have their names in the press, interestingly enough. It seems a small price to pay. But it's all the usual bases that have been built up during the Iraq and obviously Afghanistan conflicts, too. So we really have good base access there with our regional partners who were very keen to see some action taken.
Okay.
That's going on.
That's our out bump. We'll be right back, Veterans Radio. This segment is being brought to you by the Legal Help for Veterans. By the way, if you have a question for Dr. Grant, 844-VET-838. 844-VET-838. Give us a call. We'll screen that call. We'll put you on. We'll be right back right after this important messages.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Yeah, we're back here on Veterans Radio with my partner Dale Thronberry, and with me, our guest today, Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of
IRIS.
I know, but I want to get that right. The Independent Research for the U.S. Air Force. Dr. Grant, we're going to talk now. I know we're just touching on things, but I want you folks just to give you a little bit of an overview on what the heck is going on in the Asia Pacific theater. China. Xi Jinping, the new premier, president, whatever they call him, since 2012. He's a foreign policy natural, absolutely. And he's leading his country you had Mao Zedong, he made Chinese people stand up. Deng Xiaoping made Chinese people rich. Xi Jinping will make Chinese people strong. Tell us about Xi Jinping.
Xi Jinping, he really is a kind of a Hollywood figure almost. We expect to see him get his own reality show one day. He sort of led a bit of a charm offensive. Like, we know he's married to a very popular Chinese singer, so that gives him a little bit more glamour. He's traveled a lot. He went down to Fiji, he's been to Sri Lanka. He always comes and dispenses aid. So he is really on a bit of a charm offensive, and it's really been strong through 2014. But the underlying reality that everyone notes is that we really are, as Ash Carter, who is about to become Secretary of Defense, has said, that we are in a great strategic transition. China is on the rise. The economy is growing. It's not perfect, but its growth is steady. The growth of their military power is really simply unprecedented in the number of new types of ships that they build, aircraft, all of this, and in their increasing use of these forces in training and operations in their coastal waters and beyond. So this is the strategic reality of our time. We've got a lot of other things going on, whether in the Middle East or with Russia, which we need to talk about too. But underneath it all, what's really driving the change in the international security sphere is this rise of China, led by the glamorous Xi Jinping.
Well, is he a strong communist? What exactly do you feel is his agenda?
Yeah, and he's strong for sure. And you know, they're all communists, so that's kind of a common denominator in that particular brand of Chinese communism. But what the leaders have in common, and Xi Jinping is an example, it's time for China to take its rightful place on the world stage. We think of China of 50 or 100 years ago as a country that was slow to modernize and beaten down by stronger Western powers, and that suffered a lot in World War II. But what we see now is China rising in its own eyes to the place that it should always have held by virtue of its long history of civilization and invention and its culture. So China wants to be a big power on the world stage, and economically they are, and they are building a military to match that and engaging with Xi Jinping in a much more intricate and forward foreign policy that a great power needs to have. So that is what he's doing. He's making China the great power that China believes it deserves to be.
Well, who's got the bigger stick, the U.S. or China?
Who has the bigger stick? That's a great Teddy Roosevelt question. The key is really to keep the sticks in balance. And right now, I would not say that China is more powerful than the U.S. militarily. Not at all. For one thing, what the U.S. has on its side are some very powerful allies that want to help offset and balance Chinese power. One thinks of Japan and Australia, of course. But that's going to be the key with our defense policy, whatever else we do, is to continue to balance Chinese military power, which they are going to improve and improve and improve. And you see it in the new types of aircraft, Japan's Air Self-Defense Force, that's their air force, spends a lot of time intercepting Chinese aircraft that are near Japan in international waters. But what they saw recently was a new type of spy plane. And that's just another example of here we are with China with a new sophisticated electronic signals gathering aircraft out in the battle space. So that's just what we are seeing in the Asia-Pacific region, and that's why, despite other events that pop up, it's really about planning for China. The Pentagon made a pretty interesting announcement back in the fall, in the September 2014 time period, and they said, hey, it was Undersecretary for Acquisition Frank Kendall, who's an engineer, Army veteran, smart man. He said, we need a new offset strategy, something so that we can innovate and keep our lead over countries like China. We need to see more innovation from industry and innovation within the armed services in order to keep American military power at the leading edge.
I've never heard of offset strategy. What the heck is that?
That's one of those Pentagon words, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. There was another offset strategy back a couple decades ago where the key was to offset the Soviet Union's superiority in numbers with a qualitatively better force, so more precision, more advanced weaponry. And so they're talking, this real insider talk, about another offset strategy. As China's forces grow bigger, ours have gotten a bit smaller, we need to keep the quality of American military power superior to offset the growing threat from China.
Well, you would certainly think that they would want to do that, considering that they have a billion people and we have 300 million. So we have to be, maintain their superiority, I guess, technically. Correct?
That's right. And they launched 17 new warships in the year 2013. They have more aircraft in their air force. They aren't all as good as what we have, and their pilots aren't as good, but there's more of them. And they have the geographic advantages. So we are talking about an offset strategy, and it's a bit of a counterbalance for us, too. We spent some years going for the 80% solution, not buying exquisite weapon systems. And now we're back to saying, hey, we need to go for that good stuff that our smart American engineers and scientists can produce for us. We need to go for the quality again, too.
I just have a quick question about you talking about the Asian area over there with Korea, of course, North Korea doing what they're doing, and Japan. Is Japan feeling threatened by China again? I know there's that animosity that's for thousands of years.
You're right, and it really flared up, particularly over the past couple of years. There was some dialogue towards the end of 2014 that threw a little cool water into the equation. But yes, there is a great deal of a sense of threat, and it's on both sides. China feels very threatened by Japan. Japan feels very threatened by the tough neighborhood it lives in with China and North Korea. So we've seen much more air activity by Japan's air forces over the past few years, and they're running up in response to Russian flights as well. This is a year when we've seen Russian aircraft everywhere from the East China Sea to Norway. So Japan certainly is feeling that it too must maintain superior forces to keep a balance in the region.
Does China have stealth?
China does have stealth. Do they have stealth in the way that we do? Oh, maybe not quite as good, but they do appear to have figured out some of the key properties in shaping aircraft and probably in using radar-absorbing materials. They haven't produced stealth aircraft in quantity, but they do appear to have added some stealth measures to two new types of aircraft. So they have begun to open the door to that capability.
As part of the offset strategy, is there anything in the future that you could see that Japan would have its own pilots, its own planes to act as deterrent, whatever, in that region? What do you think?
Oh, definitely. Japan will buy the F-35, which is the tri-service fighter for the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps that they are buying. Japan will buy that, and that will help to maintain the balance there. It'll be a modernization program for Japan's air forces so that they'll have top-quality stealth as well.
Well, but wouldn't that sort of like be a thumb in the eye or a finger in the eye for China to have an air base so, well, I mean, we know we have the Americans, but then to have that tension between Japan and China, and then Japan now, it looks like, as you said, they're going to have planes and pilots. What about that comment?
Yes, indeed, there is that tension between them, and as China has modernized, Japan intended to modernize anyway, but really China's modernization and their increasingly more aggressive air force makes that inevitable. And so they're not aggressive in terms of attacks, obviously, but their training has really changed. For the China's air force used to just fly in daylight over their own territory, over land. Now they fly at night in bad weather and out over the ocean, and they fly a lot more than they used to. So that's an air force that's growing in its capabilities. Japan is keeping a close eye on that. And to defend their airspace, that's why they will buy the F-35. They're also buying the an upgrade to the E-2 surveillance plane, which our Navy uses on carriers. Japan uses it land-based. They need that to keep track of all the aircraft, ships, and potentially missiles and cruise missiles that may be in the air around their islands.
Now we've gone east of China. Let's go south of China to North Korea.
Well, I still have one more question.
Oh, you got more Japanese questions?
Well, I have China questions because I think we should maybe take this right to the break. For China, do they have drones?
They do. They've developed quite a range of drones, and they have some high altitude drones, medium altitude, and of course a big selection of the smaller drones as well. They seem to want to be able to use the high-altitude drones much as we would, which is for reconnaissance and collecting electronic signals information.
Okay, so they're still reclaiming lands, in particular the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. That doesn't sound like somebody wants to be friends with us.
It's hard to say. I mean, they're certainly pursuing both tracks, but we have to do the same thing. We have to trade, be friendly where that's called for, but also maintain our military posture and balance in the Pacific. Because Americans were used to either having friends or enemies, it's going to be a duality with China for decades to come, and we'll have to get used to keeping that balance with them.
Okay, folks, we're going to be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant and the Asia-Pacific Theater right after this very important message.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for five decades. so, it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
Oh, we're back with Dr. Rebecca Grant from the IRIS. That's the Independent Research Organization that she's the president of. Think tank for the Air Force. Dale, you had a comment.
I did. I just wanted to continue through the continent over there, down to North Korea, and see what's that guy up to over there?
North Korea. I can remember just 5 or 10 years ago, no one thought of North Korea as a big cyber attack possibility. But we have seen, so how interesting then, in 2014 we see really the first time that the U.S. government has put sanctions on a country for a cyber attack against a U.S. company, of course, Sony Pictures. Really out of left field, and yet it turns out that there had been a very mysterious cyber attack in March of 2013 against South Korea. A couple of television stations and some other media outlets suffered a denial-of-service attack, and at the time, Seoul and South Korea said, hey, it's the North Koreans doing this cyber attack, but nobody really paid too much attention, and North Korea denied. And yet here we see where the FBI has clearly stated that this was indeed a North Korean attack. So, you know, we always knew it would come at some point that there would be an attack and that there would be a reprisal. This is the first time the U.S. has been involved in that. So we'll look back historically, and this will have crossed a threshold for us.
You know, with this kind of cyber bullying, could this possibly be a tinder to lead to war?
Could it be a tinder to lead to war? That's an excellent question, and, you know, we're just not sure yet, I think. You know, the president's response was very measured. He sort of quoted John Foster Dulles and said, we will respond at the time and place of our own choosing, leaving it very mysterious. Of course, we know there was a disruption of North Korea's internet. Now, in North Korea, you can't just get on the internet like we can here. You have to be in the military or one of the elite. So the average citizens there do not have internet access. So when North Korea's internet went down, it was only hurting, the bad guys and the key elite cadre. So someone, we don't know who, caused that disruption. Could have been the U.S. government, I suppose. It could have been some independent actors. It could even have been China. But we don't know who did it. We know that that reprisal did take place. I don't think right now the bullying is going to transfer over into a kinetic attack. But you never know with North Korea. They like to pop out missiles, attack South Korean shipping, and occasionally shell South Korea. So I think if it happens, it could happen here. We could see a link between the cyber and the kinetic in North Korea.
Who was... I don't believe North Korea thought this up on their own. I don't believe that. Now, based on that, whom would you feel might have been really behind that? Or do you feel that North Korea acted solo?
It is like the Agatha Christie mystery. There are so many suspects, but if they had a partner, it almost had to have been China.
Oh.
The thing is, we have no evidence of any sort. And that's, to step back, that's a little bit like how it goes in cyber. So secretive, so used for espionage and for keeping tabs on everyone that we have very little real evidence of exactly who did this. It's tough to trace in the cyber world, too, because an attack could run through many countries as it bounces from machine to machine and network to network before it hits the target. So even when we look at disruptions in the U.S. that we think may have been caused by China, it's not uncommon to see them have run through servers in other countries, including even the U.S. So hard to trace, and so far the policy of most governments has been to be very secretive about how much they can see of the Internet and how much they can see these attacks.
Now, in this country, we have millions of cyber nerds, whatever. They're out there. Why couldn't we send our folks to crash in, bust down their door? Is that anything like that being considered to be in their Internet to start stealing their stuff? Quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo. Well, I think from a technical standpoint, it's certainly feasible. When you say, is it being considered, that's really the question. And it's different from our other areas of military policy where we debate it out. The cyber all takes place behind closed doors, and so we really would not know if it's being considered or not. You can look at the president's very cryptic statement where he says, we'll respond when we choose to, and say that maybe that's a hint that the cyber option is on the table. It was certainly a small proportionate. The Internet only went down in North Korea for a little while. So if you were going to respond to a cyber attack with a cyber attack, that's probably how it would look. But this is all speculation. We know what's technically possible, but we do not know what is being done within the policy realm in this area. Big mystery.
It is a big mystery. My next question is about Russia. And where are they going? Premier Putin is, you know, he's trying to build the Russian, reputation back again as being hardcore, and it's not seeming to be working too well. Their economy is collapsing since it's dependent upon oil, and is the price is being lowered artificially just to punish them? Where do you see Russia going in the coming year?
That's right. Putin is many things, but mysterious isn't really one of them, is it? He sort of has it all hanging out there. You're right to cite oil. I think oil is a potential trigger of crisis here. We just don't know. But Putin, who came to power in about 2001, has done so as the Russian economy grew and really expanded on those oil revenues. So we've seen some shocking behavior. Who would have believed, Bob and Dale, a year ago, that we would watch the Olympics and then watch Russia annex the Crimea?
Right.
Goodness gracious me. But they've done it, now done deal, and out of the headlines. Took place all over. We've also seen much more aggressive use of Russian military forces, obviously, in Ukraine. But there was a Russian fighter jet that darn near bumped off a Norwegian F-16 a couple months, early in December, came within 65 feet. That's way too close.
That is.
For unfriendly aircraft.
Yes, at 600 miles an hour.
Right,
yes.
And we've seen certainly a wonderful, firm stance taken by our Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, an Air Force General named Philip Breedlove. That's the job Eisenhower once had, and now it's General Breedlove, and he has been very firm. First of all, he's not the kind of man you want to mess with. He drives a Harley, and he's big and tall and tough. But he's been very firm, as has NATO, in their resolve to hold the line. They've beefed up their air patrols in the Baltic countries. They've assisted Poland. But oil is what could really unravel this for Putin. The dilemma is whether Putin will continue to use foreign policy adventures to consolidate and shore up his domestic power base. If there's unrest in Russia with his leadership, he could easily choose to do something dramatic across borders in order to keep Russians behind him and supporting him. And
like,
that, to me, is the worry.
Like what?
Oh, I wouldn't want to guess. Well, you know,
come
it's
on,
a really could... big border, so just close your eyes and point in any direction. Certainly the more aggressive aircraft flights are one thing. But could he go further into pressuring Ukraine? Hard to say. I wouldn't take anything off the table. So it's really going to be up to NATO and Europe to stand firm and draw some lines.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes. Can you believe that? Boy, the time has really gone. And now I want to talk about your favorite subject, the Air Force. Off we go into the, all that.
I thought it was her Harley.
What's that?
I thought it was her Harley.
That's the Air Force. You know that's my favorite subject.
You flew in a B-2 bomber. And tell us about that.
I did. I was so fortunate. I was the 587th person to fly in a B-2. Most of those, of course, are the B-2 pilots and commanders, so I was incredibly, incredibly fortunate to fly in July from Whiteman Air Force Base in a B-2 that is number 21067. It's a bomber that was a veteran of combat strikes in Kosovo in 1999 and also in Iraq. Very, very proud to fly in that aircraft. You know, it's a flying wing. They're the only flying wings in the world, so you sit in the cockpit and look not at, there's no fuselage, and you just look down that incredibly long, stiff wing. It flies beautifully, and it's more like a, the pilot who flew the aircraft, of course, said it's a computer. We've taught to believe that she is an airplane. And was, these B-2s have a mind of their own. Wonderful aircraft.
Was it quiet?
Very quiet, and a very soft feel. So you could feel each little ripple in the evening air over the skies of Missouri and Kansas. But it was a very delicate feel. The aircraft also turns amazingly. You bring the wings up to 45 degrees of bank, and it just whips around. Very, very different from the handling qualities of a B-52 or even a B-1, which is a pretty agile aircraft. There's a very, very delicate feel to it and yet an incredible power. And, of course, it's all a fly-by-wire aircraft, incredibly sophisticated, really beautiful experience. I was lucky to be on a flight where another aircraft was practicing formation flying. So I got to be in a formation of three. Very special, considering we only have 20 of these aircraft.
Did you take a selfie?
Are you kidding? They don't let you take any electronics.
I was just going to ask.
That's a very secure base. Well, I left my phone at the hotel, so I don't have a selfie, but I do have some other pictures, and it was wonderful. We landed just shortly after sunset, beautiful pink sky, and down we came. We also got to refuel, which is something I've done in other planes. But very exciting in the B-2 because it requires, even more than another aircraft, some real delicate flying to refuel there. And I was allowed to fly just for a few minutes, just for very, very briefly.
Wow.
To take the controls, yeah.
And how'd that feel? I mean, was it just respond?
It brought tears to my eyes. It brought tears to my eyes. What a wonderful feeling of the power. And, of course, they'd cleared the airspace for 10 miles around me just in case, you know.
You didn't strafe Toledo, did you? No.
No. I tried just to.
That's right. Because there's no armament on that. Okay.
No gun. No huge bomb bay. We weren't carrying weapons, obviously, but big bomb bay, but no gun on the B-2. That's right.
Okay. We've only got a couple minutes. I'm going to make this real fast. A few years ago, I was at Dayton, Ohio, at the air show, and an Air Force colonel said, "You know what? The F-22 is going to be the last manned aircraft in the Air Force." Now I hear about a JVX. Why don't you tell us about that? We've got about 2 minutes.
Right. The F-22s have been around a while, so the Air Force is thinking about producing a sixth-generation fighter and what that will look like. But they have it open wide. It might be a manned aircraft. It might be something else entirely. They're looking at all their possible options. Certainly they'll continue to build F-35s, and they're going to build a new training aircraft. We will see also a new bomber awarded probably this year. It's being carried on in great secrecy, but we know that Boeing and Lockheed teamed up and built one version. Northrop Grumman's built another. No idea what they look like, but we're likely to see a decision by the Air Force to buy that new bomber sometime later this year in 2015.
Dale, I think we could call that a scoop.
It could be a scoop.
That's a scoop.
Is that meant to be replacing anything, such as, you know, a little B-52 action?
I think they'll probably take out some B-1s first, would be my sense, and then eventually the B-52s. Yes.
Oh, there's our theme. Okay, Dr. Grant, thank you. Well, it's always a marathon. I hope you have a pot of tea or something when you do these for us, and they keep your throat. I want to thank you very much for being away from your family, from your husband and your daughter, and all the folks there in Washington. Would you come back again with us in about 5 months or so? Would you please come back to Veterans Radio?
I'd love to come back to Veterans Radio. I love the show.
Well, folks, you couldn't have. Thank you very much. Dale, you got something to say?
No, just thank you for always being available to us to get the facts of what's really going on out there.
Yeah, it
thank
makes
you,
it
Dale.
Cool. Okay, folks. Well, here we are, Veterans Radio 2015. Dale, you're going to be next week. Real quick.
We're going to be talking about the Veterans History Project. We're going to be talking about how you can get your family members to participate.
There we go. Until next week, you're dismissed.